Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yeah, so we did King Lear last week and another light comedy for this week. The End of the Affair by Graham Greene.
He is such a lighthearted writer.
He is, yeah. And there's no way we could do this alone. So you have a couple of guests with you, and let us know what's going on over there.
Yeah, so my daughter Hannah.
Hi.
And my daughter Rose.
Hi.
Excellent.
Two of the best people at talking about books that I know, and Hannah's the reason that any of us have read this book. I have a feeling you might have read it before, but she read it and loved it and just pounded on me till I read it.
I really wouldn't have done if I hadn't listened to Colin Firth read the audiobook, and he's so good.
Oh,
it's the only one he's ever done, because he only did it because he loves that book so much. And I just can't even imagine how the audiobook companies must be breaking down his door every day trying to get him to record literally anything else he wants to, and he just will not.
That's awesome. I both read it and listened to it, so I did both, and he is amazing. That was really good. Incredible reading.
Yeah, and it actually makes me think so well of Colin Firth. I mean, I already did anyway,
but I know.
I'm like, wow, he loved this book so much. He's got depths.
He does.
And then we have Rose, who has been referenced before on the podcast. She's good at story.
She is.
I've been on the podcast before.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So what is this book we have before us? Speaking of Shakespeare.
Okay. Yeah, it's kind of Shakespearean, except it's not a tragedy in the end. But it's told from two different points of view, and it's kind of goes back and forth in time a little bit, but it starts off being told by the man of a couple that were having an affair. And he's very bitter and very angry because the affair has been broken off. So as he starts telling the story of the whole situation, you learn about him, about the woman, Sarah, and a few other people. And then at about halfway through, Sarah picks up the story. Because one of the reasons that the man is so upset, Bendix?
Yeah, there's an R in there.
Okay, good thing I read it so I could speak the words. Anyway, but he's really upset because she broke the affair off suddenly and he doesn't know why. And so he thinks she's taken another lover. And he's obsessed with finding out about this. And when the book picks up halfway through, we hear from her side of the story what was going on. And it's hard to really dig too deeply into the story itself.
There's not tons of plot, yeah, right? So like it's mostly just these people thinking about the situations that they're in. So highly recommend.
The book is sounding more and more fun.
But it is fun. And the thing is, it's not, we have these events, but it's what's going on in the characters' minds that is the fascinating thing.
Human reactions to the lives that they're living and the tragedies and joys that befall them.
Right. Yeah.
And because they're reacting to things, they're not necessarily, as I was saying, they're not necessarily telling it in linear time. So you're really getting a stream of consciousness sometimes where they're kind of going back and going, oh, and then this happened too.
Yeah, I mean, these are upper middle class British people. Like, we're really digging in deep to what we think about everything.
Yeah, and he's a writer. And she's married to a government guy, but has nothing to do with her time.
Yeah.
So.
Except right. Have a family.
Yeah, she's a nurse.
Yeah. And God plays a big role in the story, too. This is definitely a Catholic novel.
Very.
And that's the thing that's kind of surprising about it, is it's so imbued with Catholicism. And Rose was saying earlier to me, she wondered how people who weren't Catholic understood the book. And it's a hugely popular book.
It's just like such a Catholic mindset that it's being told from that I think it would be a difficult adjustment for people that weren't Catholic to read it or something close to Catholic.
Yeah, I agree. There's a struggle the whole time. Well, I guess we'll have to get into that in a minute. But I mean, just to tell people what the book is, you know, it is this struggle from Bendrix and Sarah both having these journeys that we're witnessing while the affair is going on and after it has happened. That's the bit. That's the stuff right there.
Yeah, because extremely early on, Bendrix says something about there were always three people in the relationship, and he doesn't say who the third one is, mm-hmm. but he's like, and one other, and it's capital O. And so God is lurking underneath everybody's thoughts the whole time, whether they want to acknowledge it or not.
Yeah. Yeah, incredible. Incredible. Well, I feel like we should leap right into the interesting bits, into the spoiler territory.
Yeah, because we made it sound as awful as we can. So.
It is a serious book, but it is really deep. I was constantly surprised at what was going on there. And he has things to say about story too. And it feels autobiographical. I poked around a little bit, and I think some people say that this really is autobiographical because he's talking about, I mean, the main character is in first person. He's a writer. Do you guys know, is this supposed to be himself?
Yeah, he writes in the same style as Graham Greene does, like his 500 words a day and the same types of novels and all that stuff.
Gotcha. And was there an affair as well?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
I don't think he loved the book, but I can't remember now.
I don't
remember. Her, the wife who didn't love the book.
Wow.
He was always upsetting somebody like that.
Because the Bendrix was not a very pleasant guy a lot of the time.
No. I would say almost ever.
Yeah.
But I think that one of Graham Greene's real talents as a writer is to show people that are like in the muck of things. Like they're not perfect people. They're really far from perfect. They have things about them that are incredibly unlikable. And yet somehow as you read their thoughts, you're like, oh, I know exactly who this is. Or I've had thoughts just like that. And so they feel very relatable, even though they're not always likable.
Interesting. Relatable, but not likable.
But so often what Bendrix or Sarah are thinking about themselves are things that we will think about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes you realize that these people are very unreliable narrators. They're showing you the worst parts of themselves because we all tend to be harder on ourselves than other people are from the outside. Mm-hmm. We can see all the little imperfections that we're hiding from everyone else. But with Bendrix and Sarah, because it's first person, like Graham Greene is showing all of that stripped away.
Mm. And they also show us the worst. They show us the worst ways that we think and feel about God. That we want to interact with God, where we're like, no. Leave me alone. I don't want this to be true. I don't want to have to live like this. I want to do what I want to do. And even though some of them are extremely committed to it in a way that you're like, come on, guy.
Yeah.
Just give up already. But it is realistic.
Yeah. It definitely
And honestly,
is.
Yeah. And when you see the other person through, so like when you, the whole first part of the novel, it's just Bendrix talking from his own perspective. And he seems like the worst person on earth. And you don't understand how anyone could want to be in a relationship with him. But then Sarah's talking about Bendrix and she's seeing him in a different way. And in fact, the best thing that we ever hear about Bendrix, which is that he saved a guy from falling over a wall and he injures himself in the process, he never mentions once in the entire book. And she only knows about it because her husband said why he was in the hospital.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
And there's that moment at the end of the book where he's wandering around the house and he sees Henry in the way he's sleeping and he gives him the two biscuits he'd gotten out for himself. He leaves them by the bed for him. And that's a little moment of kindness that he doesn't say much about it, but he does it.
That's interesting. So do you think then that the narrator, this actually opens something up for me. You're saying that the narrator is being really hard on himself for everything that's going on. And he's writing himself as an unlikable person when possibly in real life he might be likable?
I don't know that he's more likable than he seems, but he has better impulses than he tells us about. Because I think a lot of it is that he just sees all of those parts of himself, he and Sarah both do, really clearly. So when he's talking about how much hate he has for Sarah or how much hate he has for God, I don't think he's exaggerating, but there are a lot of people that have that much hate and anger in them that don't even realize it. I feel like that's more common, actually. And so they both have an unusual amount of self-awareness, and they realize the ways in which they are falling short. And so it leads both of them to dismiss their own good qualities or the good things that they've done.
And that's what sin does, right?
Yeah.
That's one of the dangers of sin, right? Is you get to a point where you feel like you're not worthy to even go to church anymore. You know, people that get in that headspace, and that's what confession's for, is clearing that relationship back up.
Yeah, the height of hubris. I've been so terrible that God himself has never seen anything like this before. Can't believe what he's seeing.
He'll never forgive me. I am the worst. So worse than Cain.
Wow. Who he forgave. Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, the very first line of the book is, a story has no beginning or end. Arbitrarily, one chooses the moment of experience from which to look back or from which to look ahead. And I think that that is really saying what you're saying, is that this writer is choosing what to say, and he's telling us that right there at the beginning. And so now I need to read it again with that in mind, because, you know, you know, anybody who's in first person is really unreliable, especially this deep of a penetration into their thoughts. But the fact that he's putting himself down is something that's an interesting thing to me to look for.
Well, and the thing in the, he also, that story part gets mentioned toward the end too. So it's obviously important to Graham Greene. And it's also something for us. Where do we look at our story and interpret the way different actions have affected us going forward or looking backwards? Because we do this with God all the time, right? We look and go, oh my gosh, that happened and I didn't even realize it, but all these things fell in place.
Right.
And at the end of the book, it's all happening like that.
Exactly. And also at the end of the book, he's saying that what he will never lose his faith in is coincidence, not God. But coincidence versus seeing coincidence versus seeing God is also about how and where you're looking at a story.
Because I would also argue that where this book ends, like where he is in the ending of this book, is where Sarah was toward the beginning of the book, of being really angry at God and determined not to believe. But because we've already seen Sarah go through this, we feel like he's going to make the same fall. He's chosen to tell his story at a time when that hasn't taken place.
And you can tell that he does believe, because he's talking to God about how he doesn't believe in him.
Yes.
And that's the thing when he says, and we're going to talk about spoilers in just one second, huge spoilers. But for anybody who hasn't, I'm just going to say this part where he says, he robbed me. It will take more than prayers to turn this hatred of him into love. He robbed me. And like that king you wrote about, and he's talking about something that he reads in the book earlier, I'll rob him of what he wants in me. Hatred is in my brain, not in my stomach or my skin. It can't be removed like a rash or an ache. Didn't I hate you as well as love you? And he's talking to Sarah then. And don't I hate myself? But see, as I almost called you Sarah, as Hannah said, the fact that he's even acknowledging God exists and talking to him and saying, I hate you, means now he's in relationship.
Yeah.
And once you're in relationship, he's got you, man, because you can't let him alone. We've all known atheists like that who are so angry. It's like the guy Smythe in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Who he's doing all the arguments against God, and all the arguments against God just make Sarah go, oh, I didn't realize that was only 100 years afterwards that they wrote the Gospels. Oh, you know, it's not working for him at all.
Yeah, so, that was a similar experience to what I had when I was getting back into religion or getting into it really for the first time, because I fell away when I was 13, so I was never really in it at that point. But yeah, these arguments, and you're going, oh, wow. So it really, you know, that makes perfect sense. I don't know what's wrong with what you're saying, you know, that, you know, and so you're constantly running into this stuff. And even Smythe was the same way, right? I think he was, I don't know. I think he was a believer too.
Well, he was certainly engaged enough that he couldn't quit talking about it.
Yeah.
And that's when you can't quit talking about it, that means you're in the conversation.
Yeah, and it's obvious Sarah feels like he believes and is just trying not to because she talks about him being obsessed with the fairy tales, but like he's obsessed only with the bad fairy tale, or only obsessed with the worst fairy tales, but not the good part of the fairy tales.
Yeah. So good. Yeah, so I feel like we're in spoiler territory already, Julie. So let her rip. Yeah. Yeah.
So how did you feel then? Because there's that part in the middle of the book where Bendrix has said, oh, and then I got up and, you know, I felt okay and it was weird. And you find out that he actually was dead and not just injured, that Sarah had prayed him into life by asking God, save him. I don't care what, I'll never see him again. And then he walks into the room.
Yeah. And he has never gotten over the hurt of seeing disappointment on her face.
Yeah. Oh, you're fine.
Yeah. And it wasn't until he read her diary that he realized, oh, I see why. It means God is real.
But the funny thing is, that means that even in that moment, God was still more important to her than he was, because her disappointment was greater than her joy at seeing him alive.
I never thought about that.
Bam. I don't think I caught that he was really dead ever.
I didn't the first time I
when you're reading
to it.
Yeah, when you're reading the diary and she talks about, and she went running downstairs after the explosion, she could see his hand sticking out. He touched it and she was like, and he was dead.
Wow.
Well, the other thing is, he and his experience, when he relates it, he talks about how he had these bruises along his side that was almost like the door had actually landed on him, and instead he'd just been bruised by its shadow.
Exactly. Because she says, I could not have moved the door. And he was like, why did you try harder? And she's like, you don't understand. I could not have moved the door.
Right.
When he woke up, it wasn't like that.
Wow.
And when
it's subtle. Yeah. It's very subtle.
No, it is. And when he wakes up, I love it when you realize this moment. And he says, he woke up, I thought I was still on my feet. I never heard the explosion, and I woke up after 5 seconds or 5 minutes in a changed world. I thought I was still on my feet, and I was puzzled by the darkness. Somebody seemed to be pressing a cold fist into my cheek, and my mouth was salty with blood. My mind for a few moments was clear of everything except a sense of tiredness, as though I had been on a long journey. I had no memory at all of Sarah, and I was completely free from anxiety, jealousy, insecurity, hate. My mind was a blank sheet on which somebody had just been on the point of writing a message of happiness. I felt sure that when my memory came back, the writing would continue and that I should be happy. And I thought that was such a brilliant way to describe he'd been remade and set on his feet again. He almost made it. I don't know if he would have made it to heaven, but that's the feeling you get. He was pulled back.
Yeah, wow. And he says, I was lying on my back, and that what I realized that what balanced over me, shutting out the light, so not resting on him, was the front door. Some other debris had caught it and suspended it a few inches above my body. Though the odd thing was that later I found myself bruised from the shoulder to the knees as if by its shadow. And that was not how Sarah found him.
No. She couldn't move the door. The hand was just sticking out because everything else was squashed. Yeah, because it's then he goes in and she turned quickly and stared at me with fear. I hadn't realized that my dressing gown was torn and dusted all over with plaster. My hair was white with it, and there was blood on my mouth and cheeks. "Oh God," she said, "you're alive. You sound disappointed." She got up and reached for her clothes. So it's, you know, it's with the looking at him with fear. Also, is that this thing really happened? You're here alive. You know.
Wow. Yeah.
And I think also, you know, through the whole first part of the book, you're under the impression that she doesn't really care that much about him, that he loves her more than she loves him. And it's not until you read her diary that you realize that she actually did love him
more than anything.
Yeah.
And that
and part of that. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, isn't that part of him doing the describing? So in his heart, as he's writing, he's like, she never did love me anyway.
Yeah,
and so he's pouring that into it, yeah.
And also her history of having so many affairs. You know, there are the little clues all along the way that she's been having a lot of affairs. He's just one in a string of them. When she knows that the third step squeaks when somebody steps on it, so they got to be careful because it could be her husband coming back. And he goes, oh, you know.
Mm. Yeah, and I think Sarah, more than anybody else, would have been like, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah,
for him to say, like, well, how can I trust you? You've had so many affairs. How do I know you love me? She probably would have said, yeah, that's totally fair. But she really did love him in a way that she had never loved anybody else. And she had to, because there was nothing else that God could have given back to her that would have mattered that much to her, including her husband.
And it wasn't a coincidence. You know, all the things that Bendrix is brushing off at the end of the book. Oh, this. Well, anybody can have a dream about, you know, and then your ache in your side goes away. Or those are all things that everybody else who would think it's coincidence, they all know they're signs of sainthood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, miracles. And of course,
this after
and
Sarah was leaning on him in the church, so sick. He had wished that he could have had a healing touch for her.
That's right. Oh, good one. I didn't catch.
And both of her miracles were that.
Mm-hmm. And this is where it gets really Catholic, because a lot of it's about the material world being important.
He talks so much about the material being important, which is funny because you almost feel like it should be contrasted with, like, oh, this, like, physical affair that's, you know, so much tied to the body. And then it should be like the ethereal, the spiritual, the beyond that. But that's not the case. Everything is bound up in the physical, because we, of course, are physical. So it's just whether the spiritual is tied to the physical or not.
Mm-hmm.
But even with something like this affair, the spiritual can't be separated from it, because this is what brings them all to God in the end. And their love, even though it's not proper love, it's not married love, is still enough of real love to give God an entrance into their lives.
Right. And it's important too that so much of the miracles and the coincidences are physical, because that's one of Bendrick's whole things. He's like, you're not real. You're just a statue on the wall and you can't do anything.
Yeah.
I can touch her. I win. Because you'll only ever be up there and I'm here. But then God shows him over and over, I'm there too.
Mm-hmm.
I am also physical. I also a world.
Hmm.
And that's kind of why I loved that priest so much.
He was great.
He's just so down to earth. And he's like, oh, well, I'll let him rage. It's fine. He's just angry, you know, or oh, whatever. He doesn't try and bring all the intellectual stuff in like Smythe did. He knows that doesn't matter to these people.
He's seen a hate-filled moon before.
Yeah.
Probably many times.
The funny thing, though, is that one of the things that the critics are always complaining about with the religious people is how materialistic they are. But the more... Okay, so, like, there's this really great quote from Sarah's diary where she's talking about this, and it's Henry's the one who's talking about it being materialistic. But before he's talking about, oh, it's so, you know, materialistic and bound up in the flesh and all of that, there's this quote where she says, in a Spanish church. Of course, on the altar, there was a body, too. Such a familiar body. More familiar than Morris's. That it had never struck me before as a body with all the parts of a body, even the parts the loincloth concealed. I remember in one Spanish church I had visited with Henry, where the blood ran down in scarlet paint from the eyes and the hands. It had sickened me. Henry wanted me to admire the 12th century pillars, but I was sick, and I wanted to get out into the open air. I thought, these people love cruelty. A vapor couldn't shock you with blood and cries. So Henry is, like, completely missing everything spiritual that is represented in the physical of the statue.
You could have just because stopped he, it, completely missing everything. That just describes Henry all over.
Henry. But he wants her to stand there and look at columns, which is nothing but physical, without any spiritual element to it at all. It's just a column. And then he accuses the Catholics of being too materialistic.
Hmm. Well, that's nice, yeah.
So it's interesting because it is so much about the materialism of faith, but at the same time, like, everyone is bound to the material. It's just whether they acknowledge it or not. And I just think that's an unusual take, especially, like, in today's Christianity, that idea that the physical matters, that the body matters, that, you know, statues and sacraments and all that, that they matter, is so countercultural for most Christians.
And, you know, even, and that carries on through the whole book, even to the point where she's dead and everybody is trying to talk Bendrix into a Catholic funeral for her.
Even Smythe. Smythe more than anybody.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. She would have wanted it. And he's like, oh, you don't know. Oh, yeah, she was becoming Catholic and all this stuff, you know, because he truly loved her.
Right. And especially for someone who believes that it's not real. Well, she's already dead. It's not going to affect her. But it's what she wanted. What difference does it make?
But it is what she wanted.
Bendrix knows that it does make a difference deep down. And that's why he will not let it happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a really common position that you know, people that say that they're atheists have, is, you know, that position of Bendrix, where, you know, I'm not going to allow this to happen, you know, and why not? You know, it means nothing, you know. If you really are an atheist and you really honestly don't believe any of this stuff, then what does it matter? Why does it make you mad? You know, why does it upset you? And there's something to that.
Yeah. And I absolutely love that the whole thing winds up getting tied back to the fact that Sarah was baptized.
I loved it.
That was great.
And the idea that that actually made a difference in her life.
That it was real. Mm-hmm. That it always kept pulling
her
back.
Even though she never knew she was baptized.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was great. Loved that touch. Her mom was pretty funny.
I liked her mother.
Do you have 10 bucks? I need 10 bucks.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So good. But yeah, then, you know, she just, I thought that was great. You know, so she was the one who revealed that she was baptized.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so cool. You know, that happens. And then now it's like the rest of the book. You're like, oh, I mean, even before that, you know, how, I mean, this guy's just a brilliant writer. It changes the context of everything, and loved it. Thought it was great how he did it.
And just as a side note on the mother, I love that this author never wastes anybody, because she's also who Sarah uses to do a miracle, which is when Bendrix says, you know, keep me away from this girl.
Hmm.
I know I want to sleep with her, but I don't let it happen. And the mother gets in there and interferes with so much that he just tells the girl, go ahead and go. I can't come. You know? So she's important for more than one reason. Also, Henry can get angry, we find out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really interesting that he doesn't race characters like that, because he was criticizing God at the end of the book, by talking about the characters in his own novels. And he was basically accusing God of using all of the regular sinners as set dressing for saints to get into heaven and be great, but that nobody else could. And
that's really funny.
Yeah. And And who was it that said that the church is not a hotel for saint, it's a saints, it's a hospital for sinners?
I think it's just one of those things. I don't know if there's like a person it can get traced back to.
Yeah, I think they say Augustine, which if so, it's his feast day today.
Well, nice, if they say Augustine, think... then it's definitely not something anyone can trace back.
Yeah.
Because I guarantee he didn't say that.
But that is true.
He said it to a starfish, right?
Hey.
I know everybody.
The little boy on the beach.
Yeah, exactly.
With the hole.
But yeah, that's, you know, he is in the stage of believing where he feels angry at God that it's hard to be the saint that we're called to be. And he feels like only certain people can do that. We're all, the rest of us are just NPCs that are walking around in the muck. And it's interesting because, you know, Graham Greene in this novel shows us that that's also not true.
Well, yeah, because he says that as he's trying so hard to not believe in God, which means that he's resisting the pull.
Mm-hmm. But you have the detective and his little boy. You have Smythe and his sister, who presumably, you know, she sees his smooth face, so she's going to be convinced. You have this string of this ripple effect that, you know, that you and I talk about a lot, Scott, of all these actions are going to go off and influence other people also.
Mm.
You know, Henry's already kind of leaning that way. And because of Sarah, and he's kind of vague about it, but I think being around Bendrix is going to force him to be more definite about things. And that priest.
Yeah. There's this absolutely amazing quote from Bendrix toward the end of the book where he's talking to God. He says, "Loving you, I had no appetite for food. I felt no lust for any other woman, but loving him, there'd be no pleasure in anything at all with him away. I'd lose even my work. I'd cease to be Bendrix. Sarah, I'm afraid."
I love that. Because that's what happens to Sarah.
Yeah.
By the end, before she dies, she's just like, oh, take their pain away. Just let my pain be their pain. And I'm like, that's the attitude of a saint. It takes her forever to get there.
Well, yeah, because she's almost dead. She says, come off the cross and I'll go up there and take the
Oh,
pain.
I forgot that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And that's how much she loves the people around her. And that's how much God loves those people. Because saints just are reflections of something we haven't seen from God. You know?
So, Yeah, he says early on, I highlighted something that he said about saints. It was probably like in the first chapter. He says, "Sometimes I see myself reflected too closely in other men for comfort. And then I have an enormous wish to believe in the saints, in heroic virtue." And then he goes on to tell Henry what he read in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Because he's just the worst.
Right.
And that is a really common fear of giving ourselves over to God. We are really scared that it's going to mean that we're going to be someone else. And everything's going to be too different and we won't have any choices anymore. And we'll use automatons for God that are just wearing hair shirts and eating just rice bread out of penance. But really, what we can't see is that just makes us more us.
Yeah.
It doesn't change you. It changes you into who you were supposed to be, a fulfillment of what would make you happy and what would make you you.
Yeah.
It's C.S. Lewis talked about it like salting your meal. He goes, you don't taste the salt, you taste the food better. It's what it should be. And that's what Christ does for us.
Yeah. There's things like that don't make sense. Like putting salt in sweet things, which makes sugar sweeter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how pain is in life. And pain is what brings us closer to God.
Because, and you know, again, C.S. Lewis just says it so well, it's what we all know, is because we won't listen when we're happy. We only can hear when God's shouting, and he has to shout by making us suffer, because that's the only time we'll pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
So Sarah leaving Bendrix, and I love that she kept the vow, you know? even when she wanted to the most. Let's run away, he says. And she's, oh, I want to do it. I want to do it. And then she's, oh, I can't. Nope, can't do it. And but her depriving him of her presence starts that pain that makes him wind up at the end of the book talking to God, having to acknowledge him, paying attention to the fact that everything in her diary is directed to God. He thinks she's writing like sample letters to a lover. Well, she's writing to God.
Yeah. This is like a love triangle though, isn't it? But it's, but God is one of the one in the triangle, right? It's Sarah Bendrix and God.
It is. That's the man that Parkus is looking for this whole time. It's just God. Mm. And, you know, yes, her leaving is the seed of pain for him. But he also says, I have no idea why I talked to Henry when I saw him on the lawn 2 years later in the rain. He's like, it must have been God, even then, pushing at me to do this thing. And that reconnection is what made it possible to redeem the whole affair, his whole life.
Mm-hmm. And I always think that, I mean, I know the title of the book is about their affair, but I also think it's about our affair with other things besides God. It's directed to all of us in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And in a more general sense, it's, unhealthy connection. Right. Yeah. Things at the top of the mountain that aren't the right things.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because there's plenty of things that are perfectly legitimate, but not someone else's wife, you know, or whatever.
Mm.
And I also feel like you see the mercy of God in that Sarah dies when she does.
Oh, yes.
And she asked for that, too. Right. She was like, please let me just die. This is too hard.
Because the temptation was too great to stay away from Bendrix.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, her dying when she did also meant that Henry and Bendrix would have opportunities to change, to convert, that they didn't have if she would have lived.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And it's interesting that they wind up together living in that house, the two people
who Bendrix and Henry, yeah.
I've always felt like it was very monastic.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was. And there was a time where when Henry left, he brought a woman in, you know. So it's like when Henry was there, then he was in a monastery in a way. But then when he left, he was back to his old ways, or wanted to be. But he was unable to have that relation, right? He was not able to do it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that's interesting that it was monastic. I agree with that.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, it's for the same reason. Mm-hmm. They both want to be around someone else who loved Sarah and actually knew her really well, because they want to talk about that and they want to live that.
Right.
And that's what monastic life is.
Yeah.
You want to be united around somebody
through their love of Sarah.
Loves Jesus and knows God as much as you do, and as much as you hope to.
Because also, both of them have already said, like, that there's never going to be another woman. Henry said that he will never marry again. And Bendrix is still super obsessed with Sarah. So, can't even hook up with another woman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even when he tries. Like, thank goodness she was a prostitute. They're used to that.
He's like, they're so understanding.
Yeah.
I gave her some more chocolates or whatever it was, and it was fine.
They probably prefer it. They get paid
either way. Yeah, exactly. And I was thinking about what you were saying, especially about suffering, Hannah, and I came across this quote where it's Bendrix again. Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. It's Sarah's diary. And she's been trying to talk the priest into the idea that, well, I didn't have the intention of really loving Henry, I've never really loved him, so it's not really a marriage, so I could just marry Bendrix. And he's like, nope, that's not how it works. Forget it. Never mind. She's so mad. And she said, I walked out of the room where I was seeing him, and I slammed the door to show what I thought of priests. They are between us and God, I thought. God has more mercy. And then I came out of the church and saw the crucifix they have there, and I thought, of course he's got mercy, only it's such an odd sort of mercy. It sometimes looks like punishment.
Hmm.
And that's the whole thing of suffering also, is you have to feel these things and go through these things and experience them, or you don't have the same kind of understanding. And it's often the material bodily understanding of what you're experiencing.
Yeah. And you realize how much our understanding of anything like that is that of a child in our world. And yeah. This is how a child feels. You know, it genuinely feels extremely unfair. A lot of these things, and especially rules in the first place, but then consequences, those are very unfair. But They can't see that this really is the best thing for them. And to be reminded over and over that that is our understanding of the greater truth.
Yeah.
Is necessary a lot of times.
Yeah. Because Bendrix is just having a tantrum the entire time. And Sarah's the little kid going, but why? Why? You know, it's,
what if I just did this?
Yeah.
That's okay, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. I could find my way around it. Yeah.
Yeah. I love, sorry, go ahead.
No. Oh, I was going to say, she says in her diary that like the reason that she has all these affairs is because she just wants to be loved and appreciated mm-hmm. and seen by all these guys when she feels worthless. And what she winds up finding, of course, is the ultimate
hookup. Wait, what?
Basically, like, the ultimate affair, right? Like, the ultimate affair is with God. God who does see her and love her fully for who she is, not the things that she pretends to be.
Exactly.
But who she actually is.
Mm. No one can love you that much.
Exactly. So you see that it's just like a hole she's been trying to fill this whole time, and ultimately God's the only one that can fill it. But It requires more of her than she wants to give.
Well, welcome to the club.
That's right. Yeah, and even Bendrix near the end, you know, was talking about, we touched on this, but, you know, if I begin to love God, I can't just die. I've got to do something about it.
Yeah.
Right? So That's the thing right there, you know.
I know. I was just with some people last night where we were kind of mulling over the idea that you can say you believe, but you have to act on it.
Mm. Mm.
Everybody knows people who say they believe, and you're like, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. You don't act like anything's different for you, and including the way you treat the people around you or the things you give your spare time to or anything like that. So, I mean, you know, you don't want people to have to live like they're monastic, but there's always some kind of a tell, you know?
Well, for sure. Yeah. But you know, and then I think what life teaches you as you move forward, or as I have moved forward, I'll say I, as I've moved forward in sin and not followed the rules. And when you do that, it makes life hard. And it's not just because, you know, it's one of the things that, you know, when you explain to atheists, they say, well, all these rules, you know, they're dumb and all this other stuff. And you're like, well, no, they're pretty good rules. And, you know, if you don't murder anybody, your life's going to be better. And so will the people around you, you know. But these are rules that if you followed them and God wasn't in the picture, your life would be more harmonious. Just that's just true. You know, it's demonstrably true. So, but that's one of the things you learn as you move forward is that like things like the Ten Commandments, they give you freedom. If you stick to them, they give you freedom. And I've learned that through life.
Absolutely. Mm. And it's one of those things too, where, you know, I don't even know that it's so common anymore for people to say necessarily to attack the stupidity of the rules. What I see a lot is people saying it's just to control you.
Yeah. They're right.
Just trying to control you.
Interesting.
They're trying to make it so that you don't see that this is not, doesn't matter, that it's not real.
Hmm.
They just want to control your lives.
Yeah. And make
but
money.
That also comes from a really incomplete understanding of what these rules mean and what they're for and what they do for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of people who are very angry at churches, we haven't talked at all about Richard Smyth.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yep.
This poor guy, I mean, you felt really bad for him.
He genuinely
wanted, I mean, he was evangelizing as much as he possibly could. He wanted to save people from God.
Yeah.
So much that he was like, well, you don't have to come back, but can you bring the kid back?
Yeah.
Because I could save him from a lifetime of piety.
Yes. Yeah, he believes just as much as the people in the churches. Hmm. But one thing I love is that when he's first introduced, it's from Bendrix's perspective, but he says, I had an impression in the dusk of the hall of a man with a handsome actor's face, a face that looked at itself too often in mirrors, a taint of vulgarity, and I thought sadly and without satisfaction, I wish he had better taste. Then he came through into the light of the lamps. The gross, livid spots which covered his left cheek were almost like marks of distinction. I had maligned him. He could have no satisfaction in looking at himself with the glass. But what's so funny about that is that he's obsessed with the way he looks just as much as the handsome actor.
Mm.
So this idea, this impression that he gets of the person that spends all their time looking at themselves in the mirror is accurate.
It's shaped his worldview as just as much as someone who gets by on their looks.
Yeah, he's defined his entire life by this.
I had not thought of that, but that's brilliant.
Yeah, it is really good.
Yeah, and so him, you think, like, there's no way he's going to change. Like, he loves Sarah, and he's loves her enough that he's like, you can raise the kids as believers, which is a hilarious concession.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially for someone like him. You just feel like, get a hold of yourself, man. Like, I'm embarrassed to see you sell yourself out like this.
But what is so funny is, like, it is, you feel like he never would have had the faith that he had unless he had the marks on his cheek, because it's only with the marks on his cheek that he could have had the miracle.
Oh, absolutely. He just never, there's such a possibility that he just never would have thought about any of it if he had gone through life and been able to get married and
he could have been like Henry.
Differently. Exactly.
Mm.
Oh, yeah, he would have been like Henry.
Wow, very probably. True. Yeah.
Because his sister adored him and all that stuff, so.
Mm-hmm.
And he was handsome enough.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, you always get the impression that he was handsome except for the marks on his cheek.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's clearly said. You see one side of his face and he looks great.
And he's now hiding their absence.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, too. Yep.
Yeah, because of what he knows it means and what it has to mean for him that he just hasn't accepted yet.
Mm.
But he's sick of telling other people lies that he's been at a nursing home.
But he also can't not tell him.
Mm-hmm.
Because he knows that he'll understand what it means.
Yeah.
This is like a secret club. Everybody knows what's going on, but they just talk about it in code.
Yeah, the whole time.
Well, it's interesting, going back to what you said about not wasting characters, that, you know, the investigator and the kid, the same kid we just spoke of, and what happened there with the book they borrowed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was interesting that they came back. Yeah, super interesting. Talking about a secret club, you know, everybody's in it. Yeah.
And they were another example of seeing that Bendrix really was not a horrible person.
Yes.
Because he didn't want to embarrass. I mean, even if he did it sometimes, he immediately would regret embarrassing Parcus in front of his son.
Hmm.
And he wanted to be nice to them. And he felt bad for him.
And he bought the little boy too many ice creams.
Yeah.
And let him have the orange squash so he was sick. All the stuff. Yeah, and he was sharing his sandwiches with him.
Uh-huh.
They said, "Ooh, this is real ham. Oh, I get tins from America."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's his little acts of kindness like that. So I also wanted to mention really quickly, I wish I could remember. Sarah has a dream, right? Where she's going up some stairs and she's calling to Bendrix and he's up there and she's going to meet him and she's going to finally be happy. So this is the person she loves the most in the world, who she's going to meet. And it's, of course, you know, like a dream. She can't ever really meet him. And I was thinking, because he doesn't talk about dreams much in this book, but then he talks about Bendrix's dream, which I really loved. And he said he's walking up Oxford Street and he's worried because he has to buy a present and all the shops were full of cheap jewelry glittering under the concealed lighting. Now and then I thought I saw something beautiful and I would approach the glass. But then I saw the jewel close, it would be as factitious. as all the others. Perhaps a hideous green bird with scarlet eyes meant to give the effect of rubies. Time was short, and I hurried from shop to shop. Then out of one of the shops came Sarah, and I knew that she would help me. "Have you bought something, Sarah?" "Not here," she said, "but they have some lovely little bottles further on." And then he's like, "Help me, you know, I've got to find something. Tomorrow's the birthday." And she goes, "Oh, don't worry. Something always turns up. Don't worry." And he woke up hearing, "Don't worry, don't worry." And I just thought that was such a great way to show his mental change of realizing that all these things he's going after, like their affair and his love of sex and all the things that are unbalanced, are cheap and tawdry. There is something better, but you know, it'll turn up.
Yeah.
No, you can't get it just through looking for it like that.
Yeah.
I didn't even remember that dream.
That's, you read something the third time eventually, right?
So good.
Oh, no.
So where do we think Bendrix was at the very end?
I love his final prayer.
Yeah. Yeah. Leave me alone, prayer.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, God, you've done enough. You've robbed me of enough. I'm too tired and old to learn to love. Leave me alone forever.
Yeah.
The end.
The end. Yeah.
But I think it's that thing of he already knows, like, he's not going to escape.
Because right before that, he says, "I thought in the morning I'll ring up a doctor and ask him whether a faith cure is possible. And then I thought, better not, so long as one doesn't know. One can imagine innumerable cures." So he doesn't want to be cured.
Mm-hmm. But he's fighting too hard.
Yeah.
Like, he's not able to ignore it, to just put it out of his mind.
Because it's so tied to Sarah, who he thinks about all the time.
Yeah.
Can't turn away from her. If he could just forget her and act like none of it had ever happened, mm-hmm. he could maybe leave behind God, but he can't.
Yeah.
Sarah's the hook that God is using, and he'll never leave Sarah.
Yeah, she's his true love.
Yeah, and even Henry, at the end, is like, "Well, there's some good reasons." I was talking to this priest. Yeah. And he's like, "No, Henry." It's like, maybe I couldn't save myself, but I could at least save Henry.
Yeah, you're like, oh no, all of them, all of them who knew Sarah are going to have this experience.
Rose before who? Lee Spirits.
Oh, Hannah.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
Oh, shoot. That's great.
One of the things that I really love about this book, and this is honestly kind of true, I think, with a lot of Graham Greene's books for the Catholic stuff, is that it's not, like, faith is not based on intellectual arguments, ever. It's always about experience. It's about the experience that you have that you cannot ignore. There may be arguments that help back it up, or you may, like Sarah, try and argue your way out of it. But you can never ignore the experience that you've had. And so the arguments don't even really matter.
Hmm.
That's why Smythe didn't make any dent in her. Because he had other things he was saying that she'd go, "Oh, well, that's just silly." And she'd just ignore it because she was preoccupied with her own belief.
And there are people who insist on getting to faith from, like, "No, I'm going to sit down with St. Thomas Aquinas. And I'm going to reason it out, and that's what's going to decide it for me." But those are not the people that God
it's obvious
gets
like
this way.
Yeah, it's obvious that from Graham Greene's perspective, that what is important is the experience that you have, the moment when you realize that you've encountered God.
Yes.
And you may fight against it, but you've had the experience, and that can't be taken from you.
Yeah. And that, I think, is true for most people.
And what's amazing is that in this book, the person who argues that the best is actually a line from Smythe as he's talking to Sarah. Because Sarah is saying that millions of people have believed the Bible. They must have thought it reasonable. And he says, "People don't demand a thing be reasonable if their emotions are touched. Lovers aren't reasonable, are they?"
Oh, out of his own mouth comes the witness.
Yeah. And that's Sarah's entire problem.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah's entire problem is that she wants to reason her way out of it, but she can't because lovers aren't reasonable.
And God
is her new lover.
Right.
Wow. Interesting. That's great. Have either or any of you seen the movie? I have not, but I think it was Ralph Fiennes.
Make a movie of this.
This would be such a hard adaptation.
Yeah, that's why I was just going to ask if the Catholicism is in there or not.
Well, it's so internal also.
Yeah.
It's like they'd have to constantly have voiceovers or be monologuing to each other.
Yeah, it's just someone, it's a single shot. It's just someone reading a book.
Yeah.
Gosh, Fine and Julianne Moore. I don't want to watch that.
Yeah. No.
I noticed that it existed. I have not seen it. Yep.
Yeah. Hey, Rose, read that quote from...
Oh, George Orwell.
George Orwell.
George Orwell didn't care much for Graham Greene's Catholic books, at least. This is something he wrote about the heart of the matter. So the central idea of the book is that it is better to be an erring Catholic than a virtuous pagan. It is impossible not to feel a certain snobbishness in Mr. Greene's attitude, both here and in other books written from an explicitly Catholic standpoint. He appears to share the idea, floating around since Baudelaire, that there is something distinguished in being damned. Hell is a sort of high-class nightclub, entry to which is reserved for Catholics only, since others, non-Catholics, are too ignorant to be held guilty, like the beasts that perish.
Good night. Someone was projecting.
Wow. That all the while, drunken, lecherous, criminal, damned outright, the Catholics retain their superiority since alone they know the meaning of good and evil.
He felt very attacked.
I don't know if he was wrong either. I mean, Catholics will sit around and we're sat around and talk about all this stuff for so long and started off by saying, you know, it's so Catholic. Can regular people read it and like it? But how can they get all the stuff going on, you know?
Oh, yeah. I guess what my thought is like, how could someone who's not Catholic or at least very close to it like it? Because how could you? You can't read it another way.
Well, that's
I don't think my it's thinking. Not that I think they can't get it. It's that I think, how could they not get it? And why would they like that?
They'd be more like Smythe.
Yeah.
I don't care for it.
Guess who plays him in the movie? Jason Isaacs.
Oh, damn.
I know. He was a secret hottie, it turns out.
Well, it was described that way.
I know.
Now we know.
Yeah. Wow.
That's the thing. I mean, you could read it, and regular Christians can read it and, of course, get a lot out of it, but there's so much that's about the sacraments.
I'm sorry. Interesting, because I'm on IMDb and I clicked through and the director of The End of the Affair also directed The Crying Game, or wrote The Crying Game.
Oh my God.
And I thought, so that'll be interesting. You know, I think it's possible, and I'm saying this without having seen it, which isn't fair, but it's possible that if we were to watch that movie and there's no Catholicism in it, that's what people reading the book without knowing what's going on in that way are getting out of it. It's possible.
Yeah, maybe they just like the literariness of it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that, and there's also just, I mean, Graham Greene, you can tell, is an amazing author.
Oh, yeah.
The way that he weaves this story together and the way that he uses timelines, it's very seamless.
He was technically very good.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
You can all praise his technical abilities as an author.
Thank you, George Orson.
No, it's what he talks about at the beginning.
Oh, that's what people say about
what Bendrix says that the critics say about his work. So he's technically very good.
He knows what the critics say.
Yeah, that did feel very realistic. The way he talked about critics and the kind of critiques that he was getting.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like, this is honestly a book that I wouldn't like if I wasn't Catholic, because I tend to not like a lot of, you know, quote-unquote literary books, because I find them to be, like, very self-absorbed and unrealistic. But, like, this book was so... And also, I hate love triangles. I hate, like, adultery as a theme. I hate all of those things. So this had, like, none of my boxes checked. And I read it extremely reluctantly, at least 2 years after Hannah first recommended it. And
You're just like Bendrix. You're only hurting yourself.
Well, as it turns out, I was. Because it was so true in how Catholic it felt that I was like, oh my gosh, like I feel like this is speaking to me in a way that I don't know if I don't think I would like it if I wasn't Catholic.
Yeah.
Because I don't think I would be able to fully like appreciate everything he's saying and like all the little nuances where he's not elaborating on it. They're just there because it's almost like he's expecting you to be Catholic already and to know what he's talking about.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe that is what people are responding to. It's so true. You know, a lot of times when things are too literary, sometimes it feels like you need to read an analysis to understand the book. And for me, I think a lot of people read those books and they're like, it was so good that I didn't even understand it. And for me, I'm like, no, if I didn't get it, then you're bad at your job. If you wanted to write a book like that, then good job. But like,
right.
No. But this was very relatable and true. And maybe that's what people are responding to.
And I'll say too, for me, Graham Greene feels like Flannery O'Connor. Of course, he's writing in a different way and he's not being outrageous the way she is. But if Flannery O'Connor's liked by so many people now, or at least a lot more than used to be, and she's talking about stuff that's really religious and Catholic and all that kind of thing. And also, though, kind of hard to read. I mean, in the sense that you're just, I'm afraid of Graham Greene's books because, you know, they're going to be depressing and just, and very literary.
You should have heard her when she was going through The Power and the Glory.
So the thing with Graham Greene that I did from those two books, not from Monsignor Quixote, which is delightful, but those two books showed me that it's like the first half to three-fourths of a Graham Greene book is just you are in the muck. And it's hot and it's humid. There's mosquitoes. And it's just everybody's hateful to everybody. Things are being written on the bathroom walls. It's awful. And then you get to that last part of the book and it just takes off like a firecracker. Like it's fireworks everywhere. Thing after thing after thing after thing. And it's all popping it all into place. And you're just like, this is the most amazing thing I ever read. You know, and of course that illuminates for the next time you read it, I'm still kind of dreading it, but I know it was really good, so I go ahead and do it.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you could describe this entire plot. You could go through the entire plot, like read the Wikipedia summary of the plot.
Yeah.
And it would depress you. But it's not depressing when you read it.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, he gets to a place where you see where the hope is and where the salvation is. And where God is, and it's not depressing. Yeah. And I think that's actually pretty true to life, too. You hear about some people's lives, and you're like, how did you keep going?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, it wasn't that bad, you know, because of these things and this and this, and that's just how life is.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of went through that.
Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful. Well, I love it, yeah. Are there any other Graham Greene books we recommend?
Well, we're definitely going to be reading The Power and the Glory next year, so Excellent. You're going to have to buckle up for that one.
Buckling in.
This one was depressing. But so good.
So depressing.
Yeah. And you've read...
The Heart of the Matter was good, too.
Okay. And he's written, I saw on a Wikipedia entry, he's got four books that are called his Catholic novels.
Those are the ones that I've read.
Okay, so Brighton Rock, The Power and the Glory, The Heart of the Matter, and The End of the Affair.
Yeah, and Brighton Rock, I thought, was the least of the four of them.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think The End of the Affair and The Power and the Glory are the best. So that just leaves kind of
Boffling
around in the middle there.
And the ones I've read are none except for this book.
Yeah,
and I'm just going to put in, again, another reminder for people. Of course, if they stuck it out this long, they've read the book and they don't care. But Monsignor Quixote is delightful.
Yeah, it's a good one.
And it's about a priest struggling with, how do I believe what the church is telling me? Right.
And I mean, he also wrote The Third Man, so.
He wrote a lot of what he called entertainment novels, and those were his spy novels. Like Our Man in Havana.
Entertainment novels? That's the most post-World War II British thing I've ever heard anything called.
It was Graham Greene. He was, have you read about Bendrix? Yeah, he's a bit pretentious.
I know exactly where it came from. It just is too accurate.
Yeah. But so he wrote some spy novels like that.
Well, very good. Well, fantastic. Anything else you want to say to wrap it up? Anybody?
No, I think we're good. We're shaking our heads. How about you?
Nope, I don't have anything else. I loved it. I thought it was a great book. So thanks for bringing it to me. Yeah.
And once we'd all read it, we all had to talk about it with you.
I love it. And thanks for being here, Hannah and Rose. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You bet. Yeah. And what's up next for us? Is Mulk, which is a Hulk movie, I think, from
Indian Hulk movie.
Indian Hulk movie.
You know how we've been reading these really cheerful books? This is another one with a really cheerful theme.
Fantastic.
About if you are finding out suddenly that your son was a secret terrorist who blew a lot of people up.
Oh.
Maybe I shouldn't have said that. I don't know if that's,
that's a spoiler. That's a spoiler.
Okay.
And then that's hard, right? You lost your son already. Oh, wait. Now your whole family's on trial.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
This is India. We think that we can use this to get a whole class of people in jail and kicked out. Wow. It's going to be great.
Very good. Yeah. All right. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, not really me singing and dancing, sorry.
There's like one song.
Oh, yeah, there is a song when the first 10 minutes when they're all happy still.
Yeah. That's awesome. But, I'm looking at the rest of our year, and I think Love Actually is our only joy that's left right here.
Oh, no. Colin Firth is great.
Save the day again.
Right.
Very good.
I know.
All right.
Oh, my gosh, you're right. Scott, what happened to us?
I don't know. We just got bleak. You know, we knew what was going to be going on at the time, and we just wanted to feed off all of the negative energy, you know, from politics and stuff.
Never let it be said we are out of touch with the times.
That's right. That's right.
Possibly Cowboys season.
Oh, well, no, the Cowboys. I have a terrible feeling we're going to drag them right down with us, but you know.
Come on, Jerry.
That way instead of the other way around.
Come on.
They're going to drag us down because Jerry Jones.
Yeah.
Oh, Jerry Jones.
Love it. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everyone.
Yes. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.